Hi, my name is Mikhail Flotkovsky, and I'm a developer on the Office Developer Team. In this video, I'm going to show you an end-to-end walkthrough of how to build an app for Office, from getting started in coding, to diving into the new APIs, to debugging some issues, to using external web service, and of course, showing some various tips and tricks for using Visual Studio. I hope you enjoy.
Out in development, we have Mikhail here who will introduce himself and go ahead and get started.
All right. Hello, everyone. I'm Mikhail Zlotkovsky. I am a developer on the Office Extensibility team. And I'm really excited to be here. Excel, and especially Excel programmability, is something that I truly love. I before coming to Microsoft, used to work on some VBA solutions that I then converted to VSTO, a few of those add-ins. And I specifically came to Microsoft for love of Office programmability. So it's really exciting to be here to show you some of the new stuff we've been doing, particularly on the Excel APIs, the 2016 wave of APIs. But I wanted to sort of do the full end-to-end walkthrough of what does it mean to actually go and build an app. Here I am in Visual Studio. And what I will want to do is go ahead and build a new app. So I go ahead and click on New Project. So the place where you'll find the template is over here under either C# or VB. You go to the Office and SharePoint. And then you will see the Apps for Office. That is actually going to be rebranded fairly soon. But you can click on one of those. The reason, by the way, it's under C# or VB is that in addition to the JavaScript code, you can actually write server-side code as well. And I assume that a lot of the more realistic and real-world sort of solutions will actually incorporate some server-side code. So that's where that distinction comes in. For purposes of what I'm showing today, it doesn't really matter. And I will go ahead and click the task pane app. And in this particular case, all I really care about is writing the app inside of Excel. So I can go ahead and create the project. While it's doing that, it's worth noting that really you can use any tool to create these apps. It really is just a website and an XML manifest. However, using Visual Studio certainly will make your life a whole lot easier, both from a debugging perspective, the IntelliSense experience, the manifest editor, publishing, all of that. So I'll be using Visual Studio. And for today's demo, I thought it'd be kind of nice to go and try to do an end-to-end that's somewhat real world. And so I want to be able to go and read some data from Excel, use that to query a web service, then go and, having fetched the data from the web service, go put data back into Excel. And so one scenario that sort of made sense for this was a stock connector app. So I'm going to create a stock connector. So this is the HTML page. I'll keep it pretty simple. I think really all I want is so I'll want an input field of type text. I'm going to give it an ID so I can easily reference it, calling it date. And for now, let me just go ahead and give it a default value of yesterday's date. So 10/27. And then I also want to go and have myself a button that will actually go and do the action. So I'll do a break. And button update stocks. So that's my HTML page, keeping it very simple. And actually, this is using the pre-existing template that's there. So you can see, it is a little bit. It already has a div for the header and the main page. You can certainly start from scratch if you want to. Though this does keep it a little bit simpler to use the framework that's already there. On the JavaScript side, let me actually go ahead and remove the sample functionality that came in. And instead, what I want is on my button click, to do an action. So the way you would do that is, first of all, just for those who are, to really level set this, for those who are not familiar, the dollar sign, this is jQuery. jQuery is already part of the project by default. And what you do with jQuery is you can specify a selector. Pound is for divs, dots would be for classes on the HTML. And so essentially pound and then the button name, as long as those match. So that's the ID in here, the same ID in here with a pound. That creates the jQuery object corresponding to the button. And then what I do is I say dot click. And this can either take, it can take an anonymous function. So if I wanted to, I could do, you know, app.showNotification, you know, I was clicked. That's one way of doing it. The other is actually, if I wanted to instead have this as a standalone function rather than inlining the function, I can go and say function update docs. In here, I would take the same code that I would have had inside of the anonymous function. And so now, I mean, one thing I guess I could do, but that'd be a little silly, is I could do this, an anonymous function that all it does is calls my other actual function. But in JavaScript, essentially functions are first class citizens. And so you should be able to do this. In fact, actually, just for fun, let's go ahead and actually try this out. So over here in you can see I have two projects inside my solution. The web one is the one I've been working with, which is what has the JavaScript and the HTML. The other solution, that one's mostly about the manifest, but it also has a few useful properties. In this case, actually, all the defaults work for me. So I want the start action to be the desktop client. To start, I just want the a new Excel workbook. But if I wanted to launch another application and had I specified it initially or in the manifest, you know, that's where I would go and choose that. So with that, let me go ahead and launch the app. And so Excel launches. It launches with a brand new brand new file for me. So you can see it's book one, read only. Here's my text. I click update stocks, and I get the show notification happening. And actually, so the show notification, that's something that comes as part of the app template. I will use it a lot as sort of an easy way to go and do some debugging. You know, you can certainly use it in production as well, but it also happens to be a very handy way of going and making sure that something is working nicely. Let's actually, let me do a couple of things. First of all, I guess let's actually read some data from within Excel. So I'll stop debugging for now. I should say that there's actually two ways you could read the data from Excel. There is either the original, there's the Office 2013 APIs that we shipped a couple of years back, and you can certainly go ahead and use them to read data and to do other things that are sort of common across a multiple number of platforms. What I'll be showing today is actually the new Excel-specific APIs, just because they let us go and dive deeper. And so the difference between them really is both syntactic. The common APIs, as we call them, they start with Office, and it'll generally be something like office.context.document. You know, get selection data async, for example. You give it some parameters, and you get back. So you do something, and then so the coercion type, you know, might be text, and then you go and do function, and this is function result, and to that result you check for its status, and then assuming, you know, everything was good, result.value would contain your data. It's pretty transactional in terms of these APIs, whereas the new ones under the host-specific ones, they're under either the Excel namespace or the Word namespace. So you'll see them under Excel dot, you know, something. They are a somewhat different paradigm based on feedback that we gathered since we shipped the original APIs, where people wanted, you know, they wanted to be able to do more actions at the same time, not requiring all of the round trips back and forth. And also, they wanted to be able to work with objects a little bit more like they were used to in VBA, where you have this local object, you can go manipulate the state. Of course, in the case of the JavaScript APIs, it's a little bit, you know, it's not truly true. You're actually working against objects in JavaScript, and then your actual document is running remotely, either as part of your Excel desktop application or potentially on, you know, another server if you're using Office on Excel Online. And so you'll see how that pattern works pretty soon. But I just wanted to distinguish between the two different approaches you can use. Both are definitely supported. In fact, today you'll later see I'll use the Office API ones, the common APIs for the settings, for example. But for this, I'll start using the Excel APIs. Now I see we actually have a...
All right.
Looks like, okay. So what I want to do is to go and fetch data from Excel. And the pattern that we use is, unless you're doing something really advanced, what I would recommend is using the Excel.run pattern. The way it looks is roughly like this. You do Excel.run, you give it an anonymous function that accepts a context parameter, and then eventually you will do context.sync. So this is sort of the bare bones thing you'd be doing. Let me actually talk through the pieces here. So first of all, what is this context? This context represents, in some sense, the command queue of what you'll be executing. Essentially, within the host-specific APIs, so Excel and Word, you have these local objects. So for example, you have Excel.range, an object representing the range. You have the worksheet, you have the workbook, you have charts, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those objects are really proxy objects. They exist only in JavaScript. And you can use them to go and stitch together commands and actions that you want to happen. So for example, I can go and, from a range, go and ask it to get the intersection. I can then go and set, you know, particular property on the range. I can go and get the sheet. I can go and, on the sheet, add a new chart, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those are essentially commands that are being queued up that eventually, when I call sync, that is when that request goes to the server or to the desktop, you know, essentially goes back to the document and the state gets synchronized. In this case, what I would like to do is, let's say I want to create a new range object. So at the root, we have the context.workbook. And this is a collection. It has a number of things on it. If I wanted the selection, I could do get selected range, for example. But it also has worksheets. And it also has the names collection. So let me go ahead and use that. This is for named ranges. I want to get an item called stocks. And so now I have a named range. It has a few properties on it. It also has a method called getRange, so that from the named range item, I actually get the, you know, the Excel range, the cells representing that range. And so that's my range object. Now, I said, actually, let's do this. Before I actually read values out of range, let me just go and do an action with it so you can see what's happening. So I will set its fill color to red, just as a demo thing. Let's go ahead and do that. I click run. I come over here, I click, and actually absolutely nothing happens. The reason nothing happened is I committed a very cardinal sin. I did not include error handling, nor did I have a named range called stocks. So let me go ahead and fix that. What Excel.run, as well as context.sync, what they return is actually a promise object. I'll be talking about promises in a little bit. Promises are sort of a web, the new web way of handling async. So for the time being, let me just assume that it's there. With promises, the way you handle errors is you do a dot catch. And so I can do a function error. And the simplest thing will be just to do a show notification to say that I have an error, and to give the error text back. I can go ahead and click save. And if I were to run this, click update stocks, nothing happens because I need to reload. So I reload, update stocks, and now I see the item not found. Now actually, let me tell you one other thing. It's sort of a neat trick that I found. Right now, before that, I would have been able to hit breakpoints. Right now, after I've done the reload, I'm no longer able to. You see that the breakpoints will not be currently hit. One way to work around this that I find very handy when I develop is to actually come here to the HTML, and I'm going to put a horizontal break and then put a button where on click you want to window.location.reload. I'll call this button reload page. And this way, all of my breakpoints will actually be kept even as I reload the application. So you'll see that in a second. I come over here and see breakpoints are being hit. Since it looks like my webcast had gone off for a second, so the thing that I'd added was this. I'd add in a button on click event that all it does is reloads. You would not go and ship with this. However, it actually is very handy if you want to just keep on reloading real quick.
Some people are still having trouble seeing the screen. I am not, but let's just try
actually,
one more
okay.
time.
Yeah, I can see the screen data.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Keep going.
Perfect. So, let's see. Right now it's paused at a breakpoint, and it was telling me that the item not found. Quite reasonably, because I don't actually have the name range call stocks. So let me go and create the sort of data I would actually, that my app is expecting to operate on. So I have a name, I have the open, and I have a close, and let's go ahead and toss some stocks in there. Microsoft, of course, and maybe Walmart, and General Electric, and Intel. I think that's Intel. So I can go ahead and do this, create a range called stocks. I could have used bindings too. I just figured that a named range is actually a concept that people are familiar with and that you might want to do. So we're using a named range for this. And so now if I were to go and click update stocks, lo and behold, the code that I had ran, which as a reminder, what it was just I got the range out of the stocks, and then I set its fill color to red. So I'm not reading anything yet. I just wanted to demo that I can go and communicate back to the document. So now let's actually go and do something a little more interesting. But actually, before I do that, one thing is that if I actually close this workbook right now and then reopen, I will have to go and create the stocks from scratch. So if I want to avoid that, essentially if I have some test document that I'll be using over and over again, what you can do is you can go ahead and do save as. For the moment, I'm just going to go ahead and put it on my desktop, stock sample data. I did this, I close, and then back in Visual Studio, what you can do is on the solution project, on the solutions project, I can go and do add existing item. I can grab that, the stocks document. And then what I pointed out before, where the start document was a new Excel workbook every time, now I can actually say that when I run the solution, so when I hit F5, I wanted to use my sample data. So that'll come in handy as we keep on working through this. So let's actually read some values. Now, as I explained before, what we have on the JavaScript side is really proxy objects. They are not, you can create them all you want, but until you hit, you do the sync, nothing actually happens with them. And also, they don't contain data. If you wanted to load the data, you actually have to, just like there are commands to go and say that I want to set the color to red, you can also execute the load command to say that I want to load some value so that when I come back from sync, I can then read those. So let me go ahead and show you. I would do range.load values. One thing is that it's actually, this is 100% equivalent to context.load where you give it the object and the property name. So these are 100% identical. Use whichever one you want. You might see both in samples, but I find it easier to think of the object calling a load on itself with the properties that it wants. So now I do the sync, and then after the sync is complete, so this is the promises pattern, where you can go and chain promises together. And so you'll say, all right, when the sync is complete, I then want to go and do something. So for now, let's just do app.showNotification. The value is red, and then do range.values. One thing that I know people have sometimes asked me about before is, you know, this feels a little weird. Why am I returning something right here, and then there's some code afterwards? So let me try to clarify that. The intent here is what you're returning is actually the full promise. So context.sync creates a promise, and then when you do a dot then on it, it actually creates another new promise that is chained, so that it's actually the cumulative promise you're returning. And the reason you need to return this promise is so that our excel.run function knows that you're actually done. That's important because excel.run, in addition to providing you with a context object that you can work with, it does a number of other things. It actually makes sure that all of error handling gets bubbled up properly. It makes sure that if you forgot to do a sync at the very, very end, like if you had manipulated some values here, like you did some range.values equals to foo. If you did this and you forgot the sync, it will actually do the sync for you anyway at the very end. And most importantly, for objects that need referencing, or for objects that need to be tracked, which some objects do, it will actually automatically track these objects, and then when the execution of run completes, it will release them. In Excel, it's in particular, it's the range object, because essentially you have a million times multiple thousands worth of cells, plus they can be in any combination of multiple ranges. And so if you want to keep on referring to the same range, where you load some values here and then you use that to actually set the values back, that range has to be kept. As long as you're doing things inside of excel.run in a sequential fashion, and you make sure that you chain your promises correctly, and you never break the promise chain, as it's called, you will be good. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I wanted to explain what this return and the dot then is. And if you find this weird, you can also, you can call it var batch, for example, and then just do return batch. I don't know if that helps, but you could do that. I'll just do the more usual thing of where you return the thing, and then you can just, that the dot then creates a joint cumulative promise for this. So let me go ahead and run this.
Yeah, terrific.
All right, so I'm running, I click update stocks, and very good. You can actually see that the values were red. It read everything in here. So names, open, close, Microsoft, empty, empty, Walmart, empty, empty, et cetera. But I am able to read. Now let's go ahead and actually start modifying this to be a little more realistic. First of all, I actually don't need that first row, right? Because even though this is part of my named range, I really want to trim out so that it's only this range that's useful. So the way I would do that is I could do var range values equals to range dot get row of one. Remember, this is JavaScript, so it's zero based indexing, not one based indexing like it would have been with VBA. So get row of one actually gets me the row at index one starting at zero, so the second row. This right now, as is, this code would actually just give me just the first line, Microsoft. What I want, though, is actually to sort of create the range that starts here but goes all the way to the very end. And the way I can do that is I do range.row.getBoundingRectangle. And so I take the range and I create the bounding rectangle with another range. Same thing, by the way, goes for intersection, where I say that this range intersect, I give it another range, and now we get the result. So here I want to get the bounding rectangle with just the last cell, get last cell of the range. So now I have the range values. Let's actually make sure that, actually, better yet, let's do this. Realistically, I don't really need to load all of this because I don't need the empty or the old values of open and close when I go and query the data. All I want is really this column. So I can actually go ahead and create that as well. So the stock names range is the range values dot get column of 0. Again, this is 0-based indexing, so this is the first column. And let me go ahead and update these guys appropriately. So I now only want to load the values off of that, only this. Save. My application is running. And so I do reload, I update the stocks, and I actually get exactly what I wanted. I get just the four names that were typed in here. So just like any other sort of web developer, or any other developer really, when stumped with the problem of, I wonder how to actually retrieve stocks from some web service. The first thing I did was actually turn to Stack Overflow. And so I found this lovely thread asking about someone who needed to go and query some data. And I actually found this an answer that seems to do a lot of what I am trying to do. So let me just copy paste this bit. Essentially, they are using the Yahoo API service. It looks like there's sort of a query language-like thing that you pass in saying that, select something from historical data where the symbol is, this, and the start date is such and such, and the end date is such and such. And when you query it using JavaScript, they're using, in this case, so dollar, as I said, that's jQuery. So jQuery.getJSON would be a standard way to make an AJAX call, so an asynchronous JavaScript call to go and fetch some data. So let me go ahead and copy that into my solution and then modify it just a little bit. So let's see. First of all, for the start date and end date, I actually don't need those here because I'm already in the HTML. I have the text field for it. And so, and actually for now, I'll just go ahead and keep the default stocks as is. That's fine. But here, instead of the start date, what I'd like to do is use the value of my date field, which I believe I just called date, yes. So again, I'm using jQuery. You could do it other ways, but jQuery makes things quite easy. So the selector is pound because it was an ID, and date rather than data. I do, I get the value, and there's the value, and then I should be able to go and get the JSON. The other thing is here they had a callback function. One thing you can do that's a little bit easier, I find, is what jQuery returns when you do get JSON is something sort of like a promise. It actually is not a promise up to the normal spec of the ECMAScript 6 spec, or at least not yet. But they do have a similar sort of concept. So they have a dot done. And so here you do the action that you want to happen. Let me indent it a little differently. Yeah, so here's the action I want to happen once this completes. So when I retrieve back the data, and then, or actually, let me call it result. And then you can also do a dot fail function error and do something. So for the fail, I'll just do the normal thing of show notification, an error occurred while fetching data. And then let me go ahead and show the error. And then for done, for now, let me just go ahead and make sure I actually get the right data. So show notification of result. And one thing you can do that's quite convenient if you're dealing with incoming objects is you can do json.stringify. And then you give it the object, so in this case, result. What it will create is, instead of just saying that, something is an object, this will actually go through and recursively expand it. Not something you would use in production, at least not on the show notification, but it's very handy when you're debugging. So let me do this. I go back to Excel. I reload my page. I update stocks. And I get an error. Actually, there's two things worth pointing out. First of all, this is not very helpful. So let me go ahead and put a breakpoint. And if I come over here, run it again, so update stocks, I now hit the breakpoint, and I can actually inspect the error object, and I can see what are some of the things that I would have wanted to proffer up to the user. So it looks like error.statustext is what I actually want. The other question is, why is it actually erroring out? It's erroring with access is denied. I had this happen to me when I was first trying this out, so I'm not surprised. The reason this is happening, this is trying to query HTTP. However, the application itself is actually running on HTTPS. You can see that if I go back to Excel, I click over here, security info, you'll see it'll show the URL. So I'm running on HTTPS localhost 443.0.0. It is trying to access an HTTP endpoint. The browser blocks that. So you can do one of two things. You can either add an S in here, or you can actually just remove it and do the protocol independent call where you just start with slash slash like this. And that way it will work whether or not you're on HTTP or HTTPS. By the way, to preempt the question of why is it that it's HTTPS, there's actually a couple of reasons. First of all, you're actually, in the case of this being Excel Online, you're actually reading data from someone's workbook, and you're channeling it across the wire from some Microsoft data center where that workbook is to the client JavaScript. And so it is, you know, it potentially is confidential data, just like your, you know, banking stuff is, just like your email is. And so the HTTPS endpoint makes sure that there's no man in the middle who can actually listen in on that. The other thing, so that's the security answer. The practical answer is that if your app, your add-in is running inside of Office Online, the Office Online is actually an HTTPS website, obviously, because it has the proprietary data in it, which means that when your app is running inside of the iframe in there, if your app was HTTP, it would simply get blocked by normal security that the browser enforces. So when you run inside of Visual Studio, we actually just go ahead and use HTTPS by default. But so that's what was happening. Let me save this page, come back here, reload, update the stocks, and beautiful. So I got two notifications. The first one was just showing me the stocks, and then, you know, a split second afterwards, I get the result, and you can see there's some data that came back. So that gives me confidence that data is coming in correctly. One thing, so actually let's modify this a bit. Instead of the standard stock values that I got out of that Stack Overflow question, let's actually modify it to do the stocks that I care about. So for that, let's actually get the stock names. There's two ways of doing it. I'll actually show you both. I could just say that, all right, I'm going to create a new stocks array. And inside of here, I can do the standard for loop, where I say for I equals to 0, I less than stock name range. So that range dot values, we saw that was a two-dimensional array. So the dot length will give you the length of the first dimension, the count of rows. If I wanted the count of columns, I would have done values of 0 dot length. This would have given me the column count. I care about the rows in this case, so I can do this, you know, I++. And inside of here, I can do stocks.push. Now, it looks like you can see the way this is expecting the query is it wants every value surrounded by a quotation mark. So I will do quotation mark plus stock name range dot values of I of the zeroth column. That's the first column. Plus the closing quotation mark. By the way, so quotations in JavaScript, either the single quote or the double quote can be used interchangeably. So you can sort of choose based on what it is that you're trying to type out, what is the easier thing for you to do. If I was using the double quotes, I would have needed to escape the quote symbol. So this would have been equivalent. It just is a little easier and to read when I do this. So once I have those stocks, I can go and in here, close the previous sentence, close this one as well, and then say that I want stocks.join. So this will do a string join of the array. I want to separate it out by a comma. And so this theoretically feels like it should give me the right thing. Let's go ahead and try that out, actually. So I run, I save, I come over here, I reload the page, click update stocks. And it looks like, yeah, I got Microsoft, Walmart, GE, and Intel. So it is fetching correctly. Now let me actually, this is sort of the standard for loop approach. Just in case you see it elsewhere and in case it's more convenient for some situations, let me show you the other approach you can do. So as I said, stock name range is dot values, is just an array. It's a two-dimensional JavaScript array, as standard as it can be, which means that what you can do is say var stocks equals and stock named range dot values dot map. Map is a standard function that is on JavaScript arrays. It essentially, you give it a lambda function. So let me get rid of this. I have a function item, and then it will essentially go ahead and project all of your, each item, and put them into an array. So instead of me having to create the array and then push into it, I can just use the map functionality and then do the same thing as I was doing before, where it's quote followed by item. So item in this case is my row, and so the row of it's the row of values, and so item of 0 will give me the first value in that two-dimensional array, followed by closing quote. So either syntax works. Let me go ahead and come here, reload, and update. Just to show you, same thing. You can use whichever, but just that way you can kind of get a feel for, it's just the normal JavaScript array when you read the properties. It's only these initial objects that are special in that they map to some object inside of the Office document. So let me go ahead and do that. I already did do that, so you can see that the values come back. Now, one tool that I would recommend to people if they are using web services is Fiddler. Fiddler is something you can just search for it. You know, Fiddler, debugger. So here it is. You can download it. It's a free tool. Super handy. A lot of web developers use it. I've already downloaded it. So I can come here to Fiddler. And one thing you'll need to do if you're doing it the first time is you should go to Tools, Fiddler Options, HTTPS, and tell it to go and capture and decrypt HTTP traffic. HTTPS traffic. As I said before, HTTPS makes sure that your data is encrypted when it travels over the wire, and so there's no man in the middle who could have gone and sniffed it. However, with Fiddler, you actually, you know, once it already reaches the machine for which it's intended, Fiddler can go ahead and decrypt it so you can see what is the data that came through. And right now you can see a whole bunch of stuff is happening because I have the presentation open and maybe some other stuff is growing in the background. But when I come here and I do this update stocks, I should actually see, and occasionally you get these lovely messages, but you can see that there's this thing right here that came through. I can look at the JSON. It's exactly what we've JSON stringified here, but just that way, as I'm coding against this data, it's easier for me to look and see what was the format of the data that came through. So with that in mind, let me go ahead and try to extract the parts that I care about from the data that came in. So here, instead of just doing the showing the stringified results, I can do var stock values equals the result. So result was the variable that we called, and then it looks like it comes in as there's a query, on it there's results, on it there's a quote, which looks like an array that has four elements within it. So that means what I want to do is the stock values are result.query, query dot results dot quote. And then I could actually do the same trick that I just showed you with a map function from before. So data array equals to stock values. So we said it's an array, which means I can do a dot map. I do a function of for each item that came in there. So for example, this item right here and this item. I want to go and create a new array with just the values I care about. So item.symbol, item.open, item.close. And again, the way that I know that these are the property names that I care about is because I can actually see it right here. There's the close, the adjusted close, the date, the high, the low. I just care about these three. So I have my data array. And then let me, for now, make sure that I actually did the right thing. So show notification, I'll show the result. And this time, I'll still use the JSON stringify to go and show me my data array. But this time, I should not see any of the extraneous data that I've been seeing before. So again, come over here. I reload the page. I was using Fiddler to go and inspect that data, the structure of the JSON that comes to me. I get the data array, and then as we saw, I did get the values just as I was expecting. And actually, let me go ahead and I can close Fiddler now. I just wanted to show it to you earlier. So, looks like everything is working properly. So instead of the show notification, let me go ahead and actually write back to the range. The range that I cared about was just the range values that I created here that essentially encompasses this range. So I come over here, I do range values dot values equals to my data array, which is already in the right format, and then I can do context dot sync. So I save, I come over here, I reload, and a whole bunch of interesting things happen. So this is actually, I wanted to show you this error because I think people will run into it. And there's actually a couple of two really interesting subtle things that are happening. What the error is telling me is I have an invalid object path that essentially the object, this range values, if I'm trying to use it across multiple sync calls, I either have to use it sequentially inside of .run or I have to use tracked objects. So let's actually see why am I getting this error. I'll click continue for now, but let's take a look through. So for now, everything up until this point, everything was actually executing sequentially, right? I have sequential stuff here, then I do sync, then I have a dot then, and up until through here, all of this is just sequential normal JavaScript. However, when I do this AJAX call, starting on this line with a dollar dot getJSON, this is actually creating a separate async call that is no longer bound by the same sequential ordering as the previous stuff. So what is happening is from this call to data, we actually go to the end of the function. So Excel.run thinks of itself as actually done. Even this catch block sees that there were no errors that happened before. So that quits, and then execution order eventually comes back to the JavaScript, the AJAX call here with getJSON, and that's where this code tries to execute. At that point, what I mentioned before about ranges being tracked, this is where the range object has already been destroyed, because as far as Excel.run is concerned, we're actually done executing. And so that's where you get the error. The other thing worth noting is that whereas some of the errors that I was hitting before, they would just show up as part of the show notification, here it's actually, here this was a true JavaScript runtime error. And the reason is that I essentially broke the promise chain, if you will. Instead of, because this execution here happens on a different stream and at a different time than my excel.run promise with a catch that was attached to that, whenever an error happens here, it actually just bubbles up to JavaScript because when this statement throws. So, and again, I encourage you to read a little bit more about promises, but hopefully this somewhat made sense. The question, of course, is how do you actually fix it? And so there's multiple ways. You could actually go the route that the error recommended, that to use tracked objects. In this particular case, though, when I think about this scenario, is from a scenario standpoint, this is actually sequential. Like, I wanted to go and get the range object, sync, get the values, do a query, and based on that, go ahead and do some action. It's all part of really one sequential flow as far as the user is concerned. Like, sure, there's a couple of things going back and forth in terms of the JavaScript, the data coming over the wire, but from a scenario perspective, this is actually one flow. And so what it means is that if only I could go and make this here, the AJAX call, return a promise, I would actually be all set. That way I could chain it with some of my other promises. I would not be breaking the promise chain. So let's see how we would do that. One, probably the easiest way is actually to go ahead and create your own promise. Because as I said, the jQuery promises, they're not quite normal spec promises. And so it's better to just wrap the JSON call with your own promise. To do this, I will go ahead, let me actually stop execution. And so I go to the web project, and I want to bring in the Q library. You can either reference it from the CDN if you want, or in my case here, I'll go ahead and go to the manage NuGet packages. You can see this new UI that was created in Visual Studio 2015. That makes searching a little bit easier, but the same thing is available in VS 2013 as well, just under a slightly different look. And actually, I should point out, even though I'm using VS 2015, all of this is totally doable with VS 2013, as long as you have the latest updates, because the initial RTM version was not able to debug against Office 2016. As long as you have the latest updates to VS 2013, though, you'd be good to go. You'd have a very similar experience to what I have here. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and search for the Q library that I mentioned before. And so I come over here, I install, and NuGet really makes this a breeze. It pulled down the files that I needed. And so now over here under scripts, you will see I have Q library, both the debug version and the minified. And so over here in the home page, I can go, let me pin this real quick. What I can do is I can actually, oh, this is kind of a cool trick. I can come here, take this file, and just drag it, and it will create a script reference to there. Now, if I come back to over here, if I type in Q, I actually don't get any IntelliSense.
We lost you all.
We lost you again, yep.
I'm sorry. It looks like my save all is where I put it, and I can just do this cool trick of dragging, and it automatically creates the reference with a script and the appropriate relative path. So I can save that. And then on the JavaScript side, right now if I were to type in Q dot, you can actually see that I get the IntelliSense doesn't know what you're trying to do look. However, you can fix that. If you go over here to underscore references, go ahead and drag, doesn't matter the minified or not. Over here, probably the non-minified actually is better for the IntelliSense. So I drag it. What I get now is this, the reference path. I click save. And so now when I do Q dot, I actually get all of the Q methods. If this was just a one-off file, you can also do the same thing over here. It's a triple reference. So either one works. You would just here, you would need to do it as a relative path. So dot dot slash script. But in either case, that's the way you get IntelliSense for external libraries. And so with that, let me go ahead and promisify the code. If I come here to the queue reference, so it talks about how do you go ahead and create a promise. And it's actually, it's very simple. It's a pattern that you have to just go ahead and memorize once, but after that, it's actually a piece of cake. So what you do is you return a queue.promise. It's a static method. You give it a couple of functions, and then whenever you're ready to say that this promise is done, it's resolved, you go ahead and you say resolve, and you resolve it with a value that you want. Otherwise, you reject. So in practice, what this looks like is I want to, so first of all, to not break the promise chain, I want to make sure to return it. So I return queue.promise. Q.promise. It takes in a function with resolve and reject. And again, that's just the pattern. I realize it can look a little strange at first glance, but it does make sense once you've started using it. So I want to return the promise. In this promise, I go ahead and make this call that I've been making before. Let me just complete it, and then I'll fill in the relevant parts. So I do this, I do this. So what I'd like to return out of this is actually just the data. So I resolve the promise with a value of the result. On failure, I no longer need to do this show notification thing. Instead, I can just reject it with the error that I want to bubble up. And then I will rely on the show notification over here as part of the overall catch to go ahead and handle that error. So that means that I can just do reject with error.text. And so let me just make sure that this is correct. So yes, so to this dot then, or as part of this dot then, I do some sequential stuff, and then I return a promise. And that's sort of the one golden rule of promises, is you need to make sure that you either in the dot then, you're either doing stuff that is sequential, or you're going and actually returning a promise out. That will make sure you're not breaking the promise chain, which means that all of the dot catch stuff will work, and everything will be good. So let me do that. Now, after the promise happens, after the promise resolves, I want to do my other action of actually using that data. So this is where I do another dot then. Again, promises can and should be chained. That's what they're there for. And so the block of data that I wanted, or the block of stuff that I wanted to do inside the dot done earlier, I just bring it here. This the promise, it takes in the previous promise, which means that the value, the result, should actually will have been shuttled through. So dot then, a result, I do this, and again, very importantly, now that I am in, now that I'm part of the flow, I need to make sure to go ahead and return my context.sync to avoid breaking the promise chain. So let's see, let me actually zoom out real quick just to sort of get a feel for what is happening here. So I do an excel.run, sequential stuff, sync, and then I have some sequential stuff with a promise, then some more sequential stuff. Then I want to go ahead and push the updated to the values. So that's where I do the return context.sync. And then at the end, I have a dot catch that catches it all. One other note is that what I could do instead of returning the promise this way, I can actually also do dot then context.sync. You'll see us do this in some of the samples. It's really all one of the same. It's just that here, though, note, I'm not invoking it like this. I'm actually saying that the thing that I want to happen is call a function. So just like I was doing with a handler here, where I can do a dot click and give a function name, it's the exact same thing here. Dot then context.sync. This will make it so that instead of having to remember to do the return, you can just have a thing of sequential logic followed by dot then, and this is where your sync happens. Either way works, doesn't matter. And realistically, if you actually forgot the last one, because you're doing it as part of excel.run, we would actually underneath the covers insert one for you automatically. However, it is a good practice to actually do that, the statement, just so you are aware of what is flowing. And in case you aren't using the excel.run, then you certainly would need it. So either this way or return context.sync, either one works. So with that, let me run the solution. And now we should be good. So update stocks. And there it goes. So I can now see the stock values for yesterday. Let me do the day before just for fun. And sure enough, the values changed. So that's pretty cool. One thing I'd like to do with this, though, is actually make it a little more realistic and a little bit more interesting. So first of all, let's actually make sure that at the beginning, we clear out the values. That would be pretty simple. I'll postpone that. Let me do this instead. I want to go ahead and when I show the values, instead of just showing them like this, I'd kind of like to color code the values that actually went up versus down in the open versus close. So let's start with that, actually. So over here in this dot then, I want, first of all, because I'm going to be color coding, I want to make sure to clear out the previous format. So I can do range values dot format dot fill dot clear. Then for each item, I want to go and color the item. So if this was a for loop, I would have had the index. However, with dot map, I also can get the index just by putting in, it's another argument over here. Essentially, JavaScript is a very forgiving language. So whenever I didn't specify it, it just said that, you know, that's fine. But if I do want to get the index back, all I have to do is add this to dot map, or I could have done the for loop. But what I want here is to say that my row is actually, so I have my range values dot get row at the index. If my item.close, you don't get IntelliSense on this, obviously, because this is now, you know, unknown JavaScript data that you got back. So if item.close is less than item.open, I will want to go and color the row with red. So row.format.fill.color equals to red. By the way, as far as these strings go, you know, we support all of the normal, you know, 100 and something HTML known color names, or you could do something like, yeah, like this, the hex color. But I'll just go ahead and use red. Regular red, not pound red. Otherwise, I guess let me do this. Else if item.close is greater than item.open, I will go and set the format, format.fill.color to green. And then otherwise I'll do nothing, which means that it will have gotten cleared earlier, and so it'll actually just stay clear if the close corresponds exactly to open. So let's run this. I reload the page, I update my stocks, and beautiful. So it looks like yesterday, today, the stocks, two of them went up, two went down. Let me just try it out with a couple other days for fun. So update stocks. Actually, I'm not sure, did it update? Yep, there it is. Notice though that actually right now, there was a delay. And also interestingly, this did not get colored appropriately. Okay, there we go. I'm not exactly sure what happened before. So there was, however, a delay. And so maybe let's actually clear that up as well, in the sense that let's clear out the old values immediately. That way you know exactly whether something has gone through or not. So that means that over here at the very beginning, wherever I get the range values, I will want to clear everything. Except I don't want to clear everything. I want to actually keep the names. So it's actually this that I want to clear. So let's do that. The way I would do it is range values dot get column. And so I want to clear starting at column 1. And then I want to intersect it with the last column. So this is range values dot get last Doesn't really matter whether it's get last cell or dot column in this case. But I can do this. Dot clear, and what I want to clear is clear apply to dot contents. Because I don't want to clear my formatting, my nice border. I just want to clear the actual values. The other thing, actually, while I'm doing that, probably makes sense, the format clearing that I'm doing earlier, probably makes sense to bump that up as well. So we do this. Let's see how this works in action. So I reload. Yep, beautiful. So you can see that on a given day, like for a given value, it actually first clears out everything, and then when the values comes back, it populates it. So I wanted to actually kind of switch gears really quick and show you another topic that has come up. One of the things that was suggested was, all right, you know, you can go ahead and you've shown us the interaction of the JavaScript with the document, but what if I want to do some UI customization? Because part of what people hear is that the great thing about the web is that you can use all of your web skills and web tooling and web standards and all of that and the web controls. And so I thought it'd be kind of cool to go ahead and put a calendar control here. And so again, as most normal web devs do, I went and looked around what are some controls available to me. And you know, there's a lot of libraries to choose from. You can certainly use Bootstrap as sort of the new cool kid on the block. But there's also jQuery UI, which is a library that I think a lot of people are more familiar with. And so I wanted to try this out. So I come here to jQuery UI, and they've got a really nice demo where you can go click around and see how stuff works. And then you can also click on View Source to see how do they actually go and do this. So let's see, it looks like there's some CSS that's needed for jQuery UI, and then also the library plus jQuery itself. So I'll go ahead and copy all three of those. And then I can also see what script is used to actually invoke the date picker. Looks pretty nice and easy. And of course, they're using input field just like I was, so that's perfect. So this time, I'm not going to go the NuGet route. I'll just go ahead and go to my HTML page. And over here, put the script and the link. It brings in a slightly newer version of jQuery. It doesn't really matter. I think I could probably have kept with the one that I have, but it's fine. I'll just copy-paste all three as is. And this is using the CDN for jQuery. You can also see that I don't have to worry about the HTTP versus HTTPS thing, because they're already using the protocol-independent way of referencing these files. So the HTML is good. I then switch over to JavaScript. And really, it looked like it was pretty simple. I could go and do the initialization code right here. However, I generally prefer to keep things in functions unless it's a very simple, you know, like click handle or sort of thing. So I'll actually create a function called initialize date picker. And so here I have function init date picker. And this is where I'll do the actual functionality. So you could see that in the documentation, it looks like all I need to do to call the date picker is just give it the div and say dot date picker on it. In my case, though, I actually care about the format as well. But fortunately, it looks like jQuery UI has some really great documentation. So I come here to format date, and I can see, you know, how do they do it. Here they actually have a whole dropdown that keeps changing every time, so that, you know, shows the full date or whatever. In my case, I really just wanted to see how do they set this format. So it looks like you do date picker, and then you say option date format, and then whatever value you're in the format that they want. So in my case, what this will mean is I do dollar date. So I got my variable dot date picker. And then same thing, dot date picker option date format. And they use the format of the format I want is this. It actually looks like they use for YY, they actually mean the four digit year. So This is a format that I want, the year, month, and date. So if I run this, come back here, reload, click here, I actually get the calendar control. So I can check the date, you know, for the 14th, what happens, you know, here were the stock values. The only thing you may have seen is that right now when I reload, it actually looks like it loses the value. And that's one thing that you'll sort of see with web development, is that there are certain peculiarities towards, you know, in certain libraries. In this case in particular, when the date picker gets initialized, it actually does not respect the date that was in the text field initially. However, that's fine. If I go back to the documentation, I can go and find a way to set the date programmatically. I'll just do it here for you. So dot that date, date picker. I want to call the set date function. And then what I want to set it to is, say, 2015, 1026. And this way I can actually, at this point then, oh, I guess 27th is already. But at this point I don't need this. I can just do 27th here. And so if I reinitialize, reload the page, you can now see that this is coming in as a default. Now one thing, actually let me show on top of that, is theoretically, suppose, you know, right now I can go and set a date, yeah, update the stocks, everything's lovely. But then when I reload, it actually keeps reloading back to the 27th. And so one final thing I wanted to show from the API perspective is how would you go ahead and store settings? There's actually two ways you could do it. You can, you know, you could use something like window.local storage if this was something you wanted to store for the app. However, in this case, it sort of feels like since my data goes into the workbook, it makes sense for the setting of what is the last date I used to also be part of the workbook. And so I'm going to go ahead and use the Office, the common Office API, the settings API for this. So let me go ahead and do a couple of things. First of all, let me actually show you a cool trick in Visual Studio. If I hold on to, because I'm typing in date here several times in a row, and I'm about to do it even more, I want to actually create a variable out of it. So what I can do is var date. By convention, by the way, if you're creating a variable for a jQuery control, it's by convention prefaced with a dollar sign. You don't have to, just a convention. But I can do dollar date equals to pound date. And then to replace all of these, I can actually, by holding down the Alt key and dragging, I actually get vertical selection, which is really cool. That means that I can actually type in just like this. It actually replaced it on all three. So just a cool Visual Studio trick. But what I want to do is twofold. First, when the date changes, I want to go ahead and do something, namely store the settings. And so this is standard jQuery behavior where you do a dot change or a dot click, as you saw here, for example, and then you give it a function. In this case, it's a small enough thing, I will actually use an anonymous function. So what I want is office.context.document.settings.set. Sorry, looks like I misspelled. Settings.set. I want to set the date variable, or sorry, a setting name. It can be whatever I want. I think date makes sense for this though. And I want to set it with date.val. Now this, the way settings work, it actually sort of does the same proxy-like thing where whenever you set the setting, that just remembers in JavaScript that you want to set the setting. To actually push it out to the document, you do office.context.document.settings.saveAsync. I could do error handling here, but in this case, for purposes of the time, I'll just not worry about it. So I save async. And then also, so now this will save anytime I change. I also want to make sure to read in initially. And so instead of setting this date to some random string, let me go ahead and set the date to office.context.document.settings.get of my setting, which I'd called date. So I save this, come here, I reload my page. And so let's see, for example, I set the 12th, I did update stocks. Looks like that was a good day. I reload the page and the 12th stays. And if I were to actually, if I save the document right now, even though it's a sample data, whenever you save those, they do get persisted. Because you know, now it's no longer read-only. So if I save, I close, and then I come back here and rerun the application, you should actually, looks like two instances got launched. But here's my sample stock data. You can see again, that truly saved. So it's not just about reloading the page. It actually is part of the document. So I think that's probably all that I wanted to show on the API side. Actually, I suppose one other thing in terms of error handling, just to sort of complete, to make this a somewhat complete real-world scenario. Right now, you can see this works great for for regular data. But suppose I actually choose a day like Sunday, when actually there's no stocks traded. I click Update Stocks, and I get an error. It's not catastrophic, but I do actually get an error that probably is not what I would want to expose to users. And so what it's saying is that I can't get the quote of the undefined or null reference. Really, what's happening is that it's stumbling over this code right here, where there's this result object, and it looks like the result.query probably comes in empty, or maybe the result comes in empty. And so one way that I would recommend solving that particular problem would probably be to just go ahead and do a try-catch around this value retrieval. Or you can do a null check, sort of whatever's easiest. But in this case, since there's multiple nested variables, I think doing a try-catch block might make the most sense. So that way, what I do is var stock values. Essentially, I put all of. Let me think about this for a sec. So I do this. Var stock values. That way, I declare it here. That way, I do stock values equals to this. And then. I suppose if I want to be very safe, I can also say that if stock values dot length, because it's just a JavaScript array, if it equals to zero, probably want to go ahead and throw an error as well. This error, whether it fails here at the JavaScript runtime side or whether I threw an error, it will be caught by my catch block. And I can still throw an error here as well. It's just this time, I am catching the error and redirecting it so that it's my promise that goes and catches it. So I can do throw new error that will be a little more informative, saying that could not retrieve stock values from the server for the specified day, something like that. So let's try this out. If I do this, I come over here, I reload. I update stocks. Yep, and now I get the more user-friendly sort of error that I was able to intercept. And then actually one final thing on the error handling side. Right now, suppose it was actually a valid day. So we do yesterday, everything's good. But suppose I actually didn't have one of the values. Right now, I would actually get an error for that as well. The reason it's going to say that invalid argument, the argument is invalid or missing or has an incorrect format. So what's happening here? Well, first of all, if I put a breakpoint, you'll actually see, so save, reload, if I update, I actually hit the breakpoint, and even though I get the same sort of message here, the argument is invalid, there's also this debug info. This is super important because this will actually give you some additional information on where the error is happening. You can see it's happening on range.values and resetting that. And the reason it's unhappy is that I am trying to, I said that my values are actually the entirety of this range, the range values is, whereas it's coming back with only three rows. And so you're trying to set a four row thing with three rows worth of data. For safety's sake, we actually go ahead and reject that process, or reject that command, because maybe something you know, a co-author has gone in, or a user, another user has gone in and deleted somewhere else. Like, basically, you're in some sort of mismatch state. In this case, though, I actually do want to handle it just fine. This one makes sense. And so the way I would fix that problem would probably be to, let's come over here to, so let's see. So over here with the range values, instead of actually, sorry, when I do the writing of the range values, instead of trying to write to the range values, let me actually write just to the useful part, the part that actually corresponds to the number of rows that I have. And so what I can do is var range to write to equals to range values dot get row. I want to starting at the first row, but then here again I use the bounding rectangle, saying that I only want to range values dot get row based off of how many stock values dot length I got. And of course, because this is zero based, I do then minus one. So now if I do this, range values, now it should actually, when I reload, be fine with just filling in the parts of my named range that I wanted to. We're sort of starting to run tight on time, so I do know that people wanted to hear about the publishing process. So maybe let me do the kind of the abridged 10-minute version, and it might just be that we'll want to follow up with more thorough, like how do you get stuff into the store, that sort of thing.
So for anyone who, we are at the time, but for anyone who wants to stay and listen for another 15 minutes or so, we're happy to stay and
right. And if not, we'll, of course, there's going to be the recording, so you can catch up on the last 15 minutes of this when the recording comes out.
Perfect.
All right, so publishing. There's actually, so the publishing process is, there's actually two main pieces to it. You want to deploy your website to somewhere, and then you also need to get the manifest to somewhere so that the application can be inserted. These are two separate orthogonal things. The publishing, it's something that you as the developer generally control. So you might go ahead and spin up either an Azure instance, or just, you know, publish to your own FTP server. You know, however you usually do website publishing, you control that. In terms of the distribution of the app, that's where you need to create the manifest and do something with it. That something, if you want to go truly public, would be the Office Store. And so that's a process that you can certainly read about here, or just, you know, read about on MSDN in terms of how do you you create a seller dashboard account, you submit the app, it gets validated, and a few days later you're accepted to the store. For now, you know, that's obviously not something I can show in 10 minutes, but I can show how do you publish the site, and also how do you at least use the published site for debugging. Like, you can actually go and put it on a network share, the manifest on a network share, so you can at least locally go ahead and debug. I see there's a question of why do you need a website? You need a website to have the place, to have the place where the JavaScript and the HTML and the CSS are. And of course, if you did use a web, if instead of just using someone's publicly available convenient service, as I am doing here with Stocks, if you actually had your own server-side code, and, you know, talking to your database, that sort of thing, that's something that you would generally not have in JavaScript. You certainly wouldn't want your database password in JavaScript where it's easily sniffable. So instead, your JavaScript would be talking to your server, and so then that server might be ASP.NET, it might be PHP, you know, whatever it is, but it needs a place to run and actually execute. And in terms of going and creating a web service, I actually had authored an article about a year and a half ago on how would you go and create a web service for your Office add-in? So folks can just look that up, you know, create a web service for an app for Office using the ASP.NET web APIs. I use web API in this particular case, but it could be PHP, it could be any other thing. And this describes both the process of hooking up the JavaScript to it, writing the actual service. Like, this is pretty end-to-end. But anyway, back to publishing. So let me go ahead and close this now and return back to Visual Studio. So the publish process, the easiest way is actually to use the tooling that we've built into the process. So you come here, you right-click on this on the Office app, not on the web application, but on the actual Office thing that holds the manifest. By the way, this, yeah, so if you come here, if you click on the manifest, you'll actually see these are some of the places where you specify the name. So I could have called it, you know, my stock connector, a description, you know, the provider name. This also specifies, you know, what is my homepage. It specifies if I needed to specify requirements, which for this I probably should. We can go into it another time. But basically, this is where I specify what API sets do I need for my app to activate, where what hosts are supported, that sort of thing. So that's what this project is for. And I'm sorry, I just hit the publishing. So I come here, I right-click publish. And what you see is actually very similar to what I described. You know, there's two parts to it. There's the deploying of the web project and packaging the app. Right now, this is grayed out because they don't have a current profile yet. So let me go ahead and create it. There's actually two ways of going about it. If I were publishing to some FTP server that I own, I would probably just go ahead and create a new profile called FTP. And then when I come here to deploy my web project, I would specify, you know, what are the all the credentials and all the things that I need, you know, go through this process. And then eventually, you know, so the first button would deploy my web stuff. The package the app would actually then do the creation of the manifest. In my case, let me go ahead and show you how to publish to Azure, just because it is actually very quick and painless and lovely. So I come here to portal.azure.com. It'll have me log in. And so over here, I can go and create a new app. So this will be, all I want is actually just a website. Let's see. So web and mobile. All I want is a web app. And so by default, it'll create it under azurewebsites.net. That's where you get with a free website. You can then go in and specify a whole bunch of other things like your custom domain. It just if you do the custom domain, do remember you'll need a SSL certificate for the HTTPS connection. But for now, I'll just go ahead and use the default. So this will be the Mikhail Stock Connector Excel. Beautiful. And I will just go ahead and create it. And this is actually a pretty fast process. Generally, it only takes a few seconds. And then once it's done, right now it's still deploying. But once it's done, I should be able to come here and download the publishing profile. So let's hang on just a tiny bit for that. Are there any questions? Oh, and actually, it finished. But were there any pending questions in the meantime?
No, I think Rob got.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so the Azure website provides HTTPS endpoint for free, which is part of what makes it convenient. And then every person with essentially a Microsoft account can get 10 free websites. If you have MSDN subscription, you actually get a whole bunch of goodies, including the ability to then go into the public, into the custom tier of running on a custom domain and doing scaling and doing a whole bunch of stuff. But if you're just testing out, creating a free one of these is probably a very nice, easy way to go. So when I get here, I want to go ahead and download my publishing profile. This is just an XML file. Looks like I put it in my downloads folder. And so this way, when I come here to my new profile, I can import that publishing profile. So the Mikhail Stock Connector Excel, publish settings, finish, beautiful. That way, when I come here to deploy, it actually skips through all of the steps. Like it already knows where I'm going to be deploying. It already got my password. It got everything. And so I can just go ahead and click publish. And essentially, off it goes to publish the site. It only takes usually a few seconds. It just puts all of the scripts, all of my stuff, the extra things, the images, the CSS. So that is going and being published right now. you can see publish succeeded. And so if I were to go, for example, on here to app/home/home.html, since that's my site, you will see it right here. Obviously, not everything works. In fact, the way that my code was set up, I was only doing the initialization inside of office.initialize. So like that's why the click handler or the date picker are not being initialized. Conceivably, you could take this out, though then, of course, you wouldn't have been able to read the office settings. So if this is just a regular office app intended as an app rather than a site, probably just keep the pattern here. It means that you wouldn't really be able to do much from the website as is, but if the whole point is that it interacts with Excel, you probably wouldn't get very far on that either. But you can see it is published live, and to answer the question about HTTPS, you can see that I can hit the HTTPS endpoint of it just fine as well. So back to Visual Studio, to my publish page. So I've now done this first step. I can now go to package the app, and you can see it actually, it is complaining saying that, I should use HTTPS. And so let me go ahead and do that. The warning goes away. Note that all it's asking for is actually the root URL, because in terms of where my start page is, that is defined in the manifest where I showed it a moment ago, and I can show it again. So in the manifest under general, I specify that I want it, from the web project, I want the app/home/home.html. And so what happened when I created when I click publish, it opened up this office manifest folder with the XML that got created in it. And so sure enough, you can see that it substituted the HTTPS address, leaving the rest of everything as is. And so now I have something running on the web. Of course, I still need to get it into my document. And so for this, I will use the network share, which is sort of the debugging scenario, or sharing it with a couple of people sort of scenario. It's the office store that you would want to turn to if you want to make your app truly public. And of course, there's also the corporate catalog in SharePoint that's sort of the midway, where you want to make an app available just to a particular small subset of audience, within your corporation. There's articles on that, but for now, let me just show the simple thing of the network share, because that's also for myself. When I have an app in the store, the QR for Office app, and so what I do is I use my network share as my staging. Like I'll publish a site to my staging version of Azure website. I then publish the manifest. I make sure everything's good, and only then do I submit to the store. So I think if you do submit to the store, probably doing this step will still be useful to you. So let me go ahead and come here. So I go, let me actually, yeah. So in Excel, some of this I've already set up, but essentially you need to go to Trust Center, and under Trusted Add-in Catalogs, you would type in the name of your network share where you're gonna put the thing. I'll do it from scratch. So I take this manifest that I've published, and let me just go to my C drive. And since I'm doing it from scratch, I'll actually create a new folder called app manifests, copy it into here. So then I can come back to this folder, right click, and what I need to do is share. All I have to share with is just myself. It needs to become a network share. So I share with myself, share, and so what you see, sorry, I clicked too fast. It actually told me what is the address of the place where it's going to be available at. So my laptop is MI's LATCO laptop, and so this is the network folder, which means that if I go here to MI's LATCO laptop app manifests, there it is. So this is the address that I go back to Trust Center. Let me remove the old one just so you can see it sort of from scratch. So here, go here to the URL. I put in the app manifests, add catalog. So it says that it's a network share. I do want it to show it in the menu. I click OK. And I'll need to restart Excel real quick. But that way, when I come back here, I can go insert, add-ins, my add-ins. I can go to the shared folder. This now represents that network share that I just showed you a second ago. And so you can see my app in here. And so, you know, to make sure this is not smoke and mirrors, if I come here to security info, you can see this is in fact running on the Azure website. And if I were to create really quick Microsoft and Walmart, open, close, and do stocks, should be able to then select the date, update stocks, and sure enough, I see those values come through. The other thing worth noting is what do you do if you actually wanted to debug this, right? Because right now, suppose I do hit some sort of issue that I'm unsure about, or I want to sniff out what JavaScript is coming through, that sort of thing. And so if I go, I can actually, let me start from scratch. I'll close Visual Studio just so that there's not my existing solution in there. Because if you're, you know, if you're debugging your app, you might be debugging it from a different computer. You know, basically, it doesn't matter that it's on my computer. You're truly debugging the Azure instance. So you come over here, and I'll address this questions in just a moment. So you come over here to debug, debug, attach to process. And what you need to debug is actually the IE Explorer. So that's actually, it's convenient. I would close, go ahead and close your IE browser so that all you have is just the two instances corresponding to the app running. So select both of those. And then one other important thing is that by default, it would have said automatic. You actually need to come here to the options and say that you want to debug a script. You click OK, you click attach. And so you can actually see a number of things. First of all, it brought up the DOM Explorer, which I forgot to show earlier. But even if it was closed, you can actually come here to do DOM Explorer. This is super useful because it means that I can actually go through and I can select elements that I care about. So for example, I want to go ahead and look at this button. You know, it actually expands my DOM, my document object model, to show stuff. I can also, you know, conversely, I can actually turn on this option to highlight where I am. And so if I'm tweaking some CSS, you know, trying to figure out, well, how much padding do I want? You know, I can do that. And I could have done it on my, it doesn't have to be on the deployed app. It just right now is when I thought of it. In terms of trying something out, you know, suppose I want to go ahead and modify the text color of this thing here, so I can do color red. And there you go. You know, same thing with if I'm trying to figure out, well, where exactly is this div? You know, I can see it. I can, if I wanted to, I can do background purple, and you can do much more thorough manipulations as well. You can actually go and, you know, right click, edit as HTML, bring in other HTML, that sort of thing. But anyway, that's the DOM. In terms of debugging the JavaScript, if I go to the Solution Explorer, you can see that I'm attached to the Internet Explorer process. And I've got the variety of JavaScript files that are here. And so I can click on home.html, for example. And then if I wanted to debug the change of the date picker, I stick a breakpoint, click here. And so when I click the 20th, sure enough, my breakpoint gets hit. So that's sort of that's the approach you would use to debug either in you know, on your staging or production, or even if you were not using Visual Studio, like say you actually authored your app in some other way, you could still use Visual Studio as your debugging environment for your Ruby-based app, for example. Let me go ahead and address the questions. Actually, I think there's two fairly related ones I saw floating through. Yeah. First of all, one was about obfuscation. The other one, you know, so anyone with a debugging tool can debug your app. So in terms of, you know, so the nature of JavaScript and web development is that, yes, your JavaScript is public. I mean, I can, just as much as I was doing this to my app, I can go over here to you know a website and actually you know let's take Stack Overflow. I can come over here. I can hit F12 tools. Internet Explorer has the same thing as well, where I can go and see. All right, you know here's all the elements. You know I can go ahead and you know inspect this element, and so now it's highlighted. I can actually, on my local copy here, I can go and delete stuff. Like, I can do a whole bunch of stuff. I can experiment with the styling, that sort of thing. So people do, people can see your DOM. That's just the nature of web development. In terms of your JavaScript, again, people can see, I don't know if usually this sort of thing is, on a real published app, it kind of is nested. But yeah, you can see, I can look at the jQuery minified version that they are using, and somewhere I'm sure I would actually find the Stack Overflow scripts that are running here as well. What people generally do is they will go through and, they can minify the JavaScript, but really minification and obfuscation are two different things. Minification is really making sure that you want to make the site load fast. And so rather than have long variable names, rather than having comments, you can actually go ahead and strip those so that you have the smallest possible site. And minification is usually a step you would do somewhere in between publishing and, so you would develop using normal code, but then somewhere in your publishing flow, you would either manually or through some sort of tool, go ahead and run it through a minifier and get to really tiny JavaScript. It will also, in the process of doing it, generally make your JavaScript not only smaller, but also harder to read, because it will go and rename every variable to the shortest letter it can think of, so A, B, C, D, E, et cetera, going through the list. But if you really have intellectual property, you would put it behind your own server-side code. And that's why I was saying that I do think that pretty much a lot of applications will want to go ahead and use a web service to actually do interesting stuff, whether that be to query your database, to do some sort of calculation, whatever it is. And in this article that I mentioned before, there's actually a variety of why would you want to do this? It might be to establish a database connection or something with a password, because obviously otherwise it'll be sniffed out. You want your algorithm, your IP to be kept secret. There's external data that you're fetching that you have to fetch via the server. In this case, with the stocks, I was lucky enough that it was available in JSON format, in fact, in a JSONP format. But otherwise, if it was just some XML or some JSON that was not JSONP, I could use a web server to query it on my behalf and then give it to my JavaScript. Or you might use some existing server-side libraries, the OpenXML, SDK, that sort of thing. So there's lots of reasons to use a web service. Generally, you will find that your JavaScript, the way of the web is that your JavaScript is sniffable. Some of it you can you can minify, but that's not going to obfuscate per se. Anything else as we kind of round this off?
I think we've got most of it covered. If there was anything we missed, Jacob had just mentioned if you have an IP address you want to protect, you have the option to let it run inside of a web service on the server. That way, the code will never leave your
right.
web machine.
Right. Yep. And so that's where I would. I mean, I guess I'm biased since I wrote the article, but I do think it's a good article. I do recommend you go through that if you're interested to see how would you actually author the code. And that would be, that would be C# or PHP or VB.net, whatever code that is. That is actually, that will be stuff that runs locally on the box that you deployed to. So it will never be leaked to the people who are using your site.
Okay, and John says this kind of demo is great, not just for teaching us stuff, but for making it all less scary. Thanks, Mikhail and Microsoft.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad thank this you. Was, yeah, thank you for joining. This was fun. It was sort of an experiment to see how this will go, but it sounds like, if people enjoyed it, that's great. And I think what we'll try to do is establish a more, a regular once in something, maybe like a once a month sort of session where we can get together. Folks could go ahead and send me questions ahead of time just so I can sort of thematically group them and then address, how do you write a web service? And maybe we would do that for half an hour. Or how do you do, how would you use TypeScript? Or maybe just a smattering of smaller questions that I could kind of address together. I think there was actually, there was another question. Was there something about a workbook and VS?
Oh, the Excel workbook specified in Visual Studio?
Yes. Cindy, what exactly was the question there?
Or I guess the context?
Yeah, basically to sort of talk through it real briefly. So what I was doing, if I reopen my solution, is I had a workbook inside of the manifest project just as a way of having test data that's easily available. So I can go ahead and set the, if I go to the properties here, that way I could go and set the start action to that workbook. Note, by the way, that that workbook, if I were just to open it like this, as is, it will actually say that this add-in is no longer available. Because in that workbook, you had a workbook. Yeah, so the reason I get this error is that it was something, Visual Studio deployed this add-in, but it's only available while Visual Studio is running effectively. And in fact, while you've hit F5. So at this point, when you're ready to actually take your application to production, you would probably go ahead, I believe there's maybe under share or publish, export, there is an option to actually remove any, maybe it's under info, yes, inspect workbook. I can go ahead and inspect the document for stuff, including for task pane add-ins. I inspect that, and I can actually go ahead and remove personal IP. I can also remove the task pane. And so now, it's no longer here. And then when you're ready to actually, like if this was something that I was shipping to customers as a starter template or, here, friend, let me go ahead and, why don't you try out my app? I want it added to my network share, but, I need you to try this out. This is where you would then go and use the add-in that you've deployed through your shared folder or your corporate catalog and insert that in.